Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Sebastian Thrun to the broadcast. Sebastian is the CEO and co-founder of Udacity, a for-profit education company offering massive open online courses, or MOOCs. Prior to his time at Udacity, Sebastian was a Google VP and fellow, where he was involved in the creation of, among other things, Google Glass, the Driverless Car Initiative, and Google Street View. Among his academic posts, Sebastian has been a professor of computer science at Stanford University. Sebastian led the development of the robotic vehicle Stanley, which won the 2005 DARPA Grand Challenge, which has since been placed on exhibit in the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of American History. In recognition of his contribution, Sebastian was also elected to the National Academy of Engineering and the German Academy of Sciences Leopoldina in 2007. Fast Company selected Sebastian as the fifth most creative person in the business world. I recently caught up with Sebastian in his office in Mountain View, California, and we spoke about many aspects of his fascinating career, the genesis of the idea that would become Udacity, and his inspirations in the business world, among a variety of other topics. Forum on World Class IT is brought to you by Red Hat, the world's leading open source solutions provider. Learn more at redhat.com. Sebastian Thrun, welcome to the Forum on World Class IT.
It's a pleasure being here.
Excellent. I thought we would begin with the broad appetite for entrepreneurship that you've had and brought to your career in the multiple fields and how those kind of fit together. You've done a lot of work in artificial intelligence. You now spend most of your time with Udacity, one of the prominent MOOCs. And I wonder, how does one aspect of your interest impact the other? How do you sort of describe the areas in which you've focused across your career?
Well, there's two things to it. One is I love to pick problems of really big societal importance. I mean, we can work really hard and do something that's not so important. We can work really hard and do something that's really important. So I've had the fortune to have great teachers around me that taught me important problems. So my work in self-driving cars certainly addresses a problem about safety and traffic and so on and transportation. In my work in education, we seek to address the problem of how to democratize and bring education everywhere. And these are important things. The second thing that drives me is I love to learn. I love to do things I haven't done before. And it always comes with the same kind of uncertainty and insecurities that I have when I try something new. But when I finally get through it and understand it and can make my piece of the impact, I feel extremely gratified, not just because I've made an impact, but also because I learned something new. And on this, I've done things like on Google Glass. I'm not an expert on wearable devices, but I just really want to understand what does it take to build the next generation computer. And I'm now building a university, and of course, I've never done this before, and it has all its hiccups, but it's really a great intellectual exercise to do something new.
Well, speaking of the university that you're creating, Udacity, can you talk a bit about the genesis of the idea, like where the spark came from?
So I stumbled into this after listening to a gentleman named Sal Khan, mm-hmm. of Khan Academy fame, who gave a speech about his Khan Academy. And in this speech, he let us all know that he had several tens of millions of students in his classes. And I was teaching at Stanford at the time and had tens of dozens of students in my classes. And it felt I should really try something different and see if I could do what I do and scale it up to many people. So my co-instructor, of the name of Peter Norvig, and I decided about 2 years ago to take a graduate level class online and make it available for the world. It was an artificial intelligence class, and we expected perhaps 500, 1,000 people in the world might care about it, which is much more than my Stanford student body. But within weeks, we got to 160,000 students. And that number actually blew my mind. I couldn't imagine that 160,000 people in the world care about graduate-level AI. But I also realized all of a sudden, Pete and I were educating more students in the world artificial intelligence than all professors in the world combined. The real conviction to move into this is actually something else. As we taught this class, we got thousands and thousands of emails of people describing to me what their personal fate was and what impact we were having with this class. And these were soldiers in Afghanistan that fought for us. These were single mothers raising children. These were people on their deathbed. These were 11-year-old girls in Pakistan. People that you wouldn't typically find in a Stanford environment. And we were materially changing their life to the better. We gave them self-esteem, we gave them skills, we gave them employability. That was the point when I realized that at Stanford, I had a well-curated group of students that were all very, very good. And they didn't need me as much as these other people who really were much more diverse and coming from different traits of life. So I felt my impact on the world would be magnified, not just by the sheer numbers, but also the fact that, that all of a sudden I give access to people that never have access to this kind of education.
Mm-hmm. Back here in America, what do you see the impact of Udacity, the MOOCs more generally speaking, on higher education? What sort of evolution will be required? There have been those like Clayton Christensen who believe that some of this advancement, it means there are going to be a certain number of universities that go away. And hopefully this will be the sort of thing that will start to drive down the cost of education in some way as well. Can you talk a bit about your own thoughts about the impact of this on higher education?
Yeah, it's a great question, Peter. My thinking centers really about two things. One is access, and the second is quality of the experience. Access in that we have the world's best higher education system, and it's a wonderful system. And the last thing I want to do is change this. But so many people are excluded. They're excluded geographically. It's really hard for people in the world to partake in higher education. They are excluded because they don't get admitted. I mean, we have a fantastic university next door called Stanford, and I wish Stanford would admit a billion people, but they don't. And there's a financial barrier. There's also a vertical, like a demographical barrier for entry for people in mid-career. We now live in a world where it's really important to stay up to date in your skills, and that skill set changes over time. Unlike 200 years ago, where the skill set changed very little over time, today it changes very rapidly over time. And be able to stay employed, and when you lose employment, to find your next job really requires more of a lifelong learning perspective. So there's an access problem that Udacity addresses to give higher education to people at all ages. And for those people, it's often much harder to find access to higher education.
How have you selected the courses that are included in Udacity to date, and how do you see those evolving as you go forward?
We've certainly focused at Udacity on computer science and associated disciplines in STEM, which is science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, for two reasons. One is I think computer science skills are actually really important for the workforce. So we teach you modern web development, we teach you big data, we teach you statistics, the type of things that you need to be successful in the tech workforce. But also these kind of technical fields are much more amenable to online learning than, say, philosophy. In philosophy, it's really important to have great human discourse and discussion, and that's very hard to do with a computer. In computing and programming, it's really important to write good computer code, and that's much easier to do in a computerized environment.
Do you foresee that it will remain largely focused on STEM and avoiding the humanities, for instance?
So Udacity will certainly stay on STEM, and we've already gotten lots of people new careers. And we're focusing right now on basically on computer science and entrepreneurship.
That's a different path than some of your main competition, like Coursera, for instance, which has chosen a broader diet, so to speak, of courses to put on. As you think about the emerging competition across this field, how else do you differentiate yourself from some of the usual suspects that people mention in the same breath as Udacity?
Well, for me, these are all really close friends. They're almost like climbing buddies. And the best way to compare this is if someone opens a restaurant in a remote part of town and someone else opens a restaurant right next to you, that's not a competitor. That will bring more people to that part of town. And what's happening right now is thanks to this wonderful activity of online education companies and universities, we get to be taken much more seriously and many more people try us out. And that's really important to us. Now, we are obviously much more in the computer science area. And we're also the only MOOC that counts for credit and offers degrees. And our model is a little bit different. We actually believe that services are really important. Human services are an important element of education. So the type classes that we offer, actually not just computerized classes that scale, but we also individually have troops on the ground that help people succeed, like mentors and people help you understand things. And as a result, the typical finishing rates we get are significantly higher than just for the traditional MOOC.
How do you choose the universities that you partner with? Is there a criteria that you use in determining which ones are appropriate and which ones are not?
We've partnered a lot with universities and with companies, mm-hmm. and the criteria are somewhat different. We're not a broad platform the way like edX and so on are. We really make only strategic partnerships. And these strategic partnerships have really explored absolute top-notch content taught as a first-class citizen education. For me, it's really important that we have the same credentials that you commonly have in education, such as degrees. So with Georgia Tech, for example, we have a wonderful partnership. We're building up an affordable computer science degree that is really opens up their computer science education to the entire world. In fact, at a much, much lower price point, so you can now get a degree at about 15% of the cost of a regular degree. And that is an important criterion, top quality in education, but also the willingness to elevate MOOCs to first-level citizenship.
What do you see as the ongoing revenue model for the organization? How do you see that evolving as you look in your crystal ball several years out?
Well, I believe education deserves payment. It's really important. Education is a service rendered. We charge for those services. We have a really wonderful customer base right now that take our classes for credit and pay money for it. We've priced these classes lower than in traditional university environments because we're not bound to the brick and mortar expenses and we don't really carry tenured faculty inside Udacity. And as a result, we were able to reach into high school students and give them college level classes. We reached into the international world. That model is actually working quite well, and we're building it up right now into entire degrees. Where we really offer classes, we offer education, we provide services in these classes, and we charge for those services enough that we can survive as a company.
Do you foresee this extending to having people who are not typical professors being included in the curriculum, people who are authors, people who are thinkers that are outside of the academic institutions?
I would say about half our classes are made by people who aren't common professors.
Okay.
They're made by industry partners in conjunction with us. They're made by sometimes relatively young people who wouldn't even be eligible for a professor position. And what we generally find is that there's a lot of talent outside academia in really communicating in the online world complicated concepts and letting people exercise those concepts. Udacity, I think more than anybody else at this point, has attempted to change the basic modality away from kind of a lecture type modality where you listen to wise people to more of an exercise driven and almost like a video game like experience. We have this very strong belief that you can only learn when you do something yourself, when you train your own muscles. You can't just learn. You can't lose weight by watching somebody else exercise. You can't really learn by watching somebody else profess you. And as a result, the kind of classes we build are really different from most classes that people have experienced in the past. And we can do this because we are in an asynchronous medium. People can go at their own pace. And the computer is infinitely patient. So if you want to solve a problem, you're not bound by having other people that go at the same pace and have to solve the same problem at the same speed. Mm-hmm. This asynchronicity, the ability to go at your own pace, is fundamental to everything we do and really has a huge impact on the medium. So when you ask me about professors, it's very easy for a professor, of course, to do online what they've done offline, which is lecturing and so on. In the engineering disciplines, lecturing is a very common way of instructing students. It's very hard for them to make it really student-centered interactive.
Can you talk about some of the key performance indicators that you watch when you look at your own dashboard to determine whether or not the organization is making progress? What are the sorts of things that you look at?
We look for engagement. We look at repeat visits, daily active users. We look at learning outcomes. We look at the test results. We actually often do A-B testing, where we test two different ways of conveying something and observe the effect on some subsequent quizzes and exams. We have a lot of anecdotal feedback from our users and our students that report back to us what works, what doesn't work. And then we also have people on the ground that talk to people on a daily basis and get lots of core data about the learning experience and that we then incorporate back into our systems. I would say our most popular class is Introduction to Computer Science. It had over 350,000 students so far. So it's quite a number. It's taught by David Evans. And we've since changed significant aspects of the class over time to make it better based on data we collect in the field. The class is online all the time. You can take it right now, udacity.com, sign up, and you can learn how to program. You can actually build your own Google. And what we do is we watch your data as you learn, and we see where you get stuck. And as you get stuck at certain places, we go and very quietly replace certain content with other content. So the class becomes better and better.
What is that learning loop like? Are there any surprising conclusions that you could share in terms of why people get certain things wrong or where people get hung up in different courses? Obviously, as you point out, that's a big difference between the traditional lecture hall with somebody up on a stage and people who are largely passively paying attention or not, as the case may be, and more active learning that may be possible.
I could probably talk for hours about what we've learned by watching people learn. But here, give an example. We recently ran a test where we omitted certain types of videos, the so-called answer videos. Our style is that we give you a problem to solve, and then you as a student at Udacity spend some time trying to solve it. And then once you've solved it, or once you've given up, what have you, we tell you how we, the professors, solve the same problem, so you can learn from it. And we always had this nagging question, is this actually really useful? Do people really care about our solution after they've seen they solved it themselves, or are they just happy to be done with it and just want to move on, right? Like in Angry Birds, would you want to like do a level and then see somebody else perform the level, or would you just want to move on? Well, we did an A-B test last week and took out the answer videos and looked at the performance. And obviously, it's now faster. People go through the program faster. There's fewer videos. But the performance in subsequent quizzes dropped significantly. And you could really see the negative effect on learning when you left out these answer videos. So we put them back in, and we could really understand the importance of these answer videos on the learning outcomes.
How do you see this complementing the traditional educational environment? Obviously, you can't replicate or can't fully replicate the experience of being on a university campus and learning from the person who lives next to you in the dormitory and these sorts of things. But naturally, there are a lot of collaboration opportunities online, and I've read about people getting together in various cities around the world to talk about the course they're taking with some Stanford professor or some University of Pennsylvania professor. Can you talk a bit about how the experience complements the traditional university experience and maybe even ways in which you've attempted to replicate some of that?
I would say it's really a fundamentally different experience. It's asking somebody, now explain to me how the television experience differs from the radio experience, or how the movie experience differs from the theater experience. And I don't think movies are replicas or replacement of the stage, of a theater stage. In fact, in ball games, the ticket prices for the physical in-stadium experience has gone up as a sign that they're becoming more and more popular through television. So to me, it's a really different medium. It's a medium that has a different reach, has a different pedagogy. It educates differently. It might educate similar subject matters. But a lot of stuff that you can do in the classroom, we cannot do online. For example, we can't have a very tight conversation between a professor and instructor and an online student. So it really has different trade-offs, and it really is meant for different types of people.
Can you talk a bit about your own path to entrepreneurship, having gone into academics, which in many settings isn't necessarily the natural path towards entrepreneurship? You affiliated with a couple of universities in Carnegie Mellon and certainly Stanford, which have a long history of having people that have a foot in both worlds. Can you talk a bit about like when the bug bit you in terms of wanting to become an entrepreneur?
I always loved to explore new things and work on big important problems. And it might surprise, but even as a college professor at Carnegie Mellon and Stanford, I saw myself as an entrepreneur, and that I went out and took risks and tried to invent new things, build new things, such as DARPA Grand Challenge, self-driving cars. And what I'm doing right now is just a continuation of that. I guess in the area of education, I think it's good to be a little bit separate from existing universities, because the speed at which we can move, the type of people we can hire are just very different from what I could do at Stanford. You're just experimenting a lot with non-traditional ways of educating. We have a lot of companies involved that educate through us. And logical place is really to be outside an existing university. But I love what I do, and I love to use the freedom that every citizen has to really move major things forward in society.
You now live in Silicon Valley and work in Silicon Valley, obviously perhaps the hotbed of entrepreneurship for the world. As somebody who's an immigrant to this country and certainly to this area, can you talk about the impact of operating in a milieu like this?
Well, I'm in deep love with Silicon Valley and in deep love with the American dream that we can move the world if we just want to. I came from Germany, which is a bit more traditional in its way of thinking, and where risk-taking isn't as prominent as there is in Silicon Valley. In Silicon Valley, I've learned by being here that you can ask any question and you can climb any mountain. And if you don't aim high enough, you won't shoot very high. And that's really important wisdom, the way I live my life, to think about that we can change the world, because we can. In the last 10, 15, 20 years, the world has changed faster than ever before. We now have amazing technology for social interaction. We have fantastic new alternative energy methods that we drive the world forward. We are innovating in the area of transportation. Really big thing, medical and human services have made great advances in the last decades. And these are all things that didn't exist 10, 15, 20, 50, 100 years ago. This is the time to to go crazy about innovation. This is the time to just really think, rethink the world. And what better place than Silicon Valley, where you're surrounded by people that are much smarter than me and from whom I can learn a lot how to change the world.
Obviously, this is your main focus, as you point out, but you mentioned at the outset that one of your passions is to find ideas that can really change the world, to actually reiterate a point you just made as well. Are there other areas of interest that you could see yourself getting into, whether it's dabbling or investing or potentially eventually spending more time in those areas as well?
I think at my heart, I'm really a technologist, and I really love to build technology to further the world, be it in transportation or in computing or what have you. And obviously, I mean, computer technology in particular has had a huge impact in recent decades. At this point, I'm literally obsessed by trying to change higher education and really make a positive dent on society and bring access of higher education to inner city high schools all the way to the developing world. But obviously, there's a whole bunch of interesting areas that I think deserve attention and new solutions. If I were to pick one, then health and human services is certainly very much on top, where I believe a lot of breakthroughs are still outstanding. And I see a lot of potential, and obviously through Google involved in a few activities in this space.
Who were some of the people that influenced you most? Growing up, as you got into academics, who were some of the people who inspired you as you were thinking about a path for yourself?
I think there's about three people that inspire me the most. One was Tom Mitchell, who was my mentor and professor and then colleague at Carnegie Mellon. And Tom had this unbelievable ability to reinvent himself, his own career, and focus on really big problems, more so than most academics in my environment at the time. And then moving to Silicon Valley, certainly Larry Page has had an enormous impact on me. For one, his IQ is about a factor of 10 above mine, which is sometimes very humbling. So talking to him about technical ideas makes me always feel a little bit inferior. But at the same time, Larry has this amazing ability to just think logical and dive into problems with a clarity that is just really admirable. Very much along the lines, the person I have interacted very little with, but who has certainly impacted me, is Elon Musk, who inspires me through his innovation and his ability to really think logically. If I were to add a fourth person, I would probably add Sal Khan. Sal Khan had a big impact on my life. He didn't know this, he's not at fault, but he certainly played a big role in me quitting my previous job and moving into education with a big pay cut. But he just inspired me by reaching people and driving home the message. I mean, deep in my heart, I'm also an educator. I taught for most of my life. Deep in my heart, that the idea of innovation and education go hand in hand, and we should really reach out and solve problems. Anybody who says today that education is perfect probably is wrong, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. There's a lot to be done, and I can't exactly tell you that I'm on the right path. Udacity might be on the wrong path. But the idea of him quitting his job and reaching millions of high school kids was just so inspiring that I would list him as one of the four most influential people in my life.
As others seek your advice in terms of areas to focus or ways to get more involved in entrepreneurship, what sort of advice do you offer as you reflect upon the path that you've taken?
I think number one, be passionate. I used to tell my graduate students at Stanford, don't worry about what job you have to pick because your job picks you. Let your job pick you. Find something you're passionate about. Then when you're passionate, be persistent. Don't give up after half a year. Just keep doing it for a while, because progress is always hard work. It's never just an idea. It's always the hard work. And as you're being persistent, be open-minded and listen. Really listen. Too few people ask their friends what their mistakes and their flaws are. But if you don't ask your friends of what you're doing wrong, then you have no opportunity to improve. Now, to me, I'm an innovator and try to be entrepreneurial. And I try to learn. And the basic contract when you do this is to do something you've never done before. And part of that contract is you do something wrong and you're going to fail. And failing for me is as joyful as succeeding. Failing means that there's something to learn and we can improve and do it better next time. And that's important. It's important to celebrate your failures as much as your successes. And if you celebrate your failures really well, and if you get to the mode to say, wow, I failed, I tried, I was wrong, I learned something, then you realize you have no fear. If I think about why I'm in America and what makes America special, it's exactly this. Our founding fathers came over in moments of war and had to claim an entire continent for themselves and rewrote all the rules from scratch in a wonderful, wonderful way. And I think that gene of being America persists to the present days, and you find it in Silicon Valley and many other places.
How do you think about the planning process in an organization and in an industry that is so dynamic and changing so quickly?
I think you need just two ingredients, or maybe three ingredients in total. You need an objective, a vision that is irrefutably good and lives up to your values. And it's almost like you pick a mountain to climb and you have to make a decision what your objective is. You can't have a fuzzy objective. But it has to be far out, it has to be visionary. Then you need a team of people that have mutual trust, because almost no objective can be reached alone. And third, you need the next step. You need to do what is the next. Missing from this list is a detailed plan. When you climb a mountain that hasn't been climbed before, it's impossible to lay out the exact path to get up there. And you should never fool yourself about this. Any plan that you make is going to be wrong. And in fact, it's going to be painful when you realize it's wrong in two dimensions. One, you have to revise it. And second, you wasted time and energy in the past. So for me, it's much more important to say, well, when we climb a mountain, let's pick a direction jointly with a team that trusts each other and take the first step and then look where we are and then take the second step and then take the third step, then making an elaborate plan. As long as you have the confidence you can make it to the top of the mountain, you will go uphill and you will succeed.
As you think about the sorts of team that you need to put together in order to build an organization like this, how have you thought about the balance of different skills? Clearly a lot of technology skill is necessary here, but the ongoing building of this team and its growth, how do you think about the sort of staff that you need?
We certainly have specific needs right now. If you're listening to this, Udacity is looking for top-notch engineers, please apply. But by and large, I look for people who are enthusiastic and humble. People who are smart, open-minded, that understand the mission and buy into the mission. And people who, at the same time, are willing to understand that we're all learning, that grant me the right to learn and be wrong, and that put their trust in me and that I can trust on the journey. That is actually more important to me than any individual IQ test outcome or SAT score or perhaps credentials you bring with you from your previous job. I find this recipe works really well because in the end of the day, we are surrounded Udacity with about 50 people who are extremely enthusiastic about changing the way education works and bringing education to everybody. And that enthusiasm and that humbleness we hope to portray and have has really led us forward faster and better than any other decomposition I can imagine.
Wonderful. Well, Sebastian Thrun, thank you so much for taking this time and speaking with me and for sharing your insights and so many different interesting facets from your broad career. I really appreciate
it. It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Forum on World Class IT would like to thank Red Hat, the world's leading provider of open source solutions, for being our corporate sponsor. Red Hat believes in the value of a connected ecosystem to inspire innovation for tomorrow. To learn more, visit redhat.com. You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call MetaStrategy's Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the Forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to MetaStrategy's five principles of world class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important then that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.